Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest episode of The Interviews, the show that rounds up our chats with the cream of the cinematic crop. Well, actually this week we're going to start not with cinema, but with some culture. Theatre, darlings, in case you didn't know, The Producers is the hugely successful award-winning, it has more Tonys than any other show, fact fans, adaptation of Mel Brooks' classic 1967 film about a couple of hapless Broadway producers, played in the film by Cyril Mostel and Gene Wilder, who decide to mount the worst play ever in an oh-so-clever get-rich-quick scheme. The show, which has catchy numbers written by Brooks, who also co-wrote the book, debuted in 2001 and is currently enjoying a joyous revival at the Garrick Theatre in London, where the role of Max Bialystock, the lecherous old stager who forms one half of unnoted production company Bialystock and Bloom, has been taken over for a few weeks by the wonderful Richard Kind stepping in for Andy Nyman. You know Richard Kind, he's one of the kings of the 27 Percenters Club, who enhances everything he's in, whether it's Spin City, Curb Your Enthusiasm, A Serious Man, or even Inside Out, where he played Bing Bong, with his beautifully broad comedic performance style and unforgettable speaking voice. And Richard was kind enough, to pop into the pod booth last week, just after I had taken in his turn in The Producers, to which he is returning after, shall we say, an extended absence. And he was an absolute joy. The conversation goes all over the place here. I was clinging on for dear life at times. I had an absolute blast, and I hope you do too. Enjoy.
Richard Kind, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, thank you for being here. I was just saying, I saw you the other night in The Producers. You were absolutely fantastic, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass.
You can blow smoke up my ass, I'll listen.
It was tremendous.
Thank you. It's a funny show. It's foolproof. I got to tell you, first of all, Andy Nyman, who does it normally,
yeah.
I'm only here for as a guest visit for 7 weeks, is brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. I'm brilliant, brilliant. I'm kidding. But the show, honestly, the show works with anybody because the thing is a machine. It's just so good.
Is there a moment, is there a scene, is there a line that you're looking forward to every night? Because you know it's going to kill, or you know you're going to enjoy it.
Well, I love saying that's our Hitler, except that I have to say it musically. That's our Hitler! And it shouldn't be in the music. I've got to do it to the rhythm of the song,
yeah.
But it should be, that's our Hitler! You know, something like that. That's how Mostel said it, but I can't do it.
But you're not doing a Cyril Mostel impression, of course, we should say.
The whole time, yeah. I'm doing a zero. Oh, I am, because Nathan did it so brilliantly when it was created,
yeah.
And put his stamp not only on the role, but on the words, because he helped create it.
Yeah.
I can't do Nathan.
Yeah.
Nathan is singular. Flip side, I think I'm singular.
Yes,
but
you are.
I'm influenced more by Zero Mostel than I was by Nathan. And I'm much more clunky than Nathan. Nathan skated through that. He glided. He was fantastic. I'm not that. You'd get to see the sort of the grit in the gears with me. You know, I don't sing as well as Nathan. I don't move as well as Nathan. So it's just I'm blum, 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 blum. So I'm more like Cyril Mostel.
I imagine the original film was a big thing for you when you were growing
seminal,
up.
Seminal in my life. I can name the movies since we're talking about films.
Yeah.
MASH was seminal in my life. Dr. Strangelove.
Oh my God.
The Producers, definitely. What else? Those were the big ones that were sort of led me to what I liked. Oh, did you ever see a movie called Where's Papa?
No.
Well, why not?
I'll look it up right
you
now.
You people who are listening to about film, if you have not seen Where's Papa, that was the first movie that Carl Reiner ever directed.
Oh, my
God. It's George Segal, Trish Van Devere, and Ruth Gordon.
Hang on.
Believe me, if you think The Producers is bad taste, wait till you see Where's Papa. In fact, their tagline was something to offend absolutely everybody. It's great. It's the greatest. So trust me.
That's a seminal. Where's Papa?
Where's Papa is a must.
God.
That was a must.
Oh my God, I need to add that. I haven't seen everything, sadly, in George Segal's. Oh, it's available.
Is it available?
Richard, you will be delighted to know it is on Prime Video. I could watch it this evening.
You will thank me. You can
I will
call
thank
me
you.
Up and say thank you, Richard.
If you get a phone call in the next 3 days.
Yes.
And someone just simply says, thank you, Richard.
Yeah, okay. Do you have children?
Sadly, no.
And but do you have a wife who has a good sense of humor?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay. Watch it with your wife because you should laugh together. And you'll look at each other going, oh, no.
Did they really do that? So I come home tonight and say to my wife, Richard Kind has recommended a film for
us. Yes.
Believe
you're not going to have sex after it, but you'll enjoy it.
I've been married for 15 years. Richard does not.
Maybe this will drive you to sex.
Maybe Where's Papa could be my new chat-up line, if you know what I mean. So those were films that, in a way, were instrumental in getting you into acting in the first
telling
place.
Telling me who was... In fact, are we allowed to curse on this?
Of course we are.
Okay. Then I'll use the word, which I don't use. I tell my children, you can only curse if it accelerates the joke or if it enhances the joke. Mm-hmm. You cannot curse because, ow, I hurt my, blank. I was in a restaurant, and Mel Brooks was there.
Uh-huh.
And as he was leaving, I ran after him. It was before the musical was done. And I ran out, and he knew who I was, but he didn't know me. And I said, Mel, you're Mr. Brooks, I'm Richard Kind. Yeah, I know. And I go, listen, The Producers was a very important movie to me, and I understand that you're going to make it into a musical. He goes, yeah, we are. And I go, don't fuck it up. And he laughed, and he said, I'm not. And he didn't. It's 14 Tonys. He didn't fuck it up.
Yeah, he was already in the process of not fucking it up at that point.
Yes, he was, actually, yeah.
Which is, I mean, it is such a funny show. It was just a source of joy to me. I had a smile on my face entire time.
I'm glad.
It was absolutely delightful. And I love Mel Brooks. And have you seen the documentary about him that Judd Apatow directed?
Not yet. I haven't seen it yet. I'm sure I know everything. But I look forward to watching it. There's a place in that I encourage anybody who loves comedy to see in near Chautauqua, New York.
Uh-huh.
It's the National Comedy Institute, or I don't know what the exact name, but is they had a huge thing on Carl Reiner. It took me 2 days to get through that because he really does it. And there's a lot of Mel in there, but I know a lot about Mel. And I read his book listened to his book. So I know a lot about it.
Oh, it's a tremendous documentary. It's two parts. It's great. It's about Anne Bancroft, of course, and Carl. There's so much more Carl in there.
Anne really liked my Max.
Really?
Yes. When she saw it, when I opened on Broadway, and she came and she just said, she liked it. She recognized what I was trying to do with it.
Yeah.
And she was very kind to me.
That's amazing. Because for people who don't know, this is not your first Producers Rodeo.
It's
you,
not. No.
You were in the show in about 2004. Yeah, 2004.
So it's 22 years ago is when I first did it. I was younger. I could move better. Not well. Even back then, I couldn't move well. Now, and I really did this because I wanted to see, oh, can I still do it? And people could have paid a lot of money to say, you know what, he can't. But I still can, and I do it. And, it's okay.
It's so much fun but now you're an older gentleman. You're older than you were. That's how time works.
You know what? Yesterday I was older than I was. I'm older than I was yesterday.
Yeah. Sadly, that is how it works.
It is.
But do you have more of an insight into Max now that time has passed?
No,
or is he
no.
the same guy that you played him 20-odd years ago?
He's the same guy. But what's fascinating is, and I try and explain this to people, okay, I performed it on Broadway for a 1,400-seat house, the mm-hmm. St. James's 1,400 seats. I then performed it about 10 years later for four performances, mm-hmm. but at the Hollywood Bowl.
Wow.
That's 18,000 seats.
Jesus.
This theater is 700, and you're right on top of them. Now, is there a difference between how I'm talking to you mm-hmm. and how you talk on the phone? Mm-hmm. Think about that. Yeah. Think about how you talk on the phone and you're right there versus you're at a table and you're talking about, there's a difference of how I'm talking to those people. There is a difference in how I'm performing this. There's a difference in the way that the lines come out. There's not the scenery or the large stage. This is a very small, intimate theater. Max is intimate now, but still is big. He's still who he is, but it's performed differently. It's acted differently, even though the base of the character, the foundation of the character is the same. He is who he is.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting thing. And of course, the change in choreography and in staging and a different Leo, it all changes.
Yeah, so your Leo this time around is Mark Antolin. Yeah. He's tremendous.
Isn't he great?
He's absolutely tremendous.
He's a great man and a great performer.
I think the moment that he wins a crowd over is basically
a producer.
It's just fantastic.
He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I'm fascinated by how this came about for you. How you got the call. Andy's going on for 7 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And then how you fit into a show that's already running with this cast.
Well, you know, that's an easy thing, fitting in, because, you know, you got understudies, people will take over. As a matter of fact, famously, when Matthew and Nathan left, they said, oh, well, nobody's going to be as good. They're wrong. This show, as I said earlier, is a machine. Anybody will work. They didn't know that. They thought only Nathan and Matthew could do it. It doesn't need me. It doesn't need Andy. Now, Andy is spectacular. Very different. He's much closer to what Nathan does. But I came in having done it. What happened was they called and they asked, would I like to do it? My manager said, no, I'm too busy in the spring, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm doing a TV series. I had a film that I was doing. Mm-hmm. Had a talk thing that I was doing. I do these talks. So I wasn't available. Gareth Valentine, who I worked, he was the musical supervisor. I worked with him as a musical director on Guys and Dolls a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He's a friend. We still keep in touch. We're still on WhatsApp together. He sends me stuff and filthy, filthy things. He's a disgusting man. So Gareth calls me up or sends a message. Do you mind if David Babani calls you about doing Max? I go, yeah. David calls me. We have a 15-minute call. I called him, so I was charged a lot of money on my American phone bill. Was not happy about it. But David called me, and he said, listen, we'll work through anything. Any scheduling things, you have to leave it early, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I called my manager, and I said, make it work. I said, they're going to work around me. Make it work. It's 7 weeks. It's great.
Yeah,
I'm doing 7 weeks. Look at everything that's good. I'm in London. Let's start right there. I'm on the West End in London.
Yeah.
I love it here. I love this town. I love it. I love the people. And who knew I'd love the cast as much as I do? The role is great. It's a short run of a really good part. I don't like long runs. I like to tackle a part that's really good and then get out of there. I like rehearsal better than I like performing. But you perform,
really?
Okay. Yeah. But you're a performer. You know, I did Bye Bye Birdie for 14 performances 2 years ago. I'm going to do Edna in Hairspray for a week. Let me tackle that. So here I am doing Max, and it's so much fun. And London, and it's everything I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Production is great.
Yeah.
Never realized how good a production and how different it would be. I thought I'd just be doing Max again, and it's different.
It's a different director. It's Patrick Marber.
The best. You know, I never talk about him. He's filthy. He really wants he wants to one-up Mel Brooks, and he has. It's a lot of stuff is different in it. You know, he holds on to what was, and he added his own because he just wanted to say, oh, you think, Mel, you think only you got it? And he's really funny. It's good. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. He's tremendous, Patrick Marber.
And he is. Great guy, too.
So in a way, you couldn't rely on the muscle memory of 20 years ago because the staging's different.
You can't do that. I'll tell you what's interesting about the muscle memory about the lines is not learning them, but when you say the wrong words, if you put in a word, Mel Brooks knows what he's doing, and Tom Meehan, who co-wrote the book with him, they knew there was a poetry to it.
Yeah.
It flows. It's comically correct. They are comically smarter than I am. So if I say a word, in fact, last night I forgot. I have the word. It was shocking, outrageous, insulting. Mm-hmm. And I forgot the word outrageous. And I said, it was shocking, insulting. It worked, but there was a rhythm. There's a poetry to it.
Yeah.
It's like Shakespeare.
It's a rule of three.
In that it is, but it's like trying to do Shakespeare and missing a word. It doesn't sound as right.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be or maybe not to be. Not as good.
To be or not to, what was the question?
Yeah, right.
But you say that, you obviously you've been comedically inclined for a long, long time. You know your comedic onions as well.
Oh,
sir.
I'm well. Well, I'm good. Yeah. I mean, I'm not some. I do this for a living.
Yeah.
So I'm no schlub off the street.
Absolutely.
So I know where to respect the comedy. And that's what I do.
What sort of conversations have you had with Mel over the years about this?
About this?
Since you asked him not to fuck it up, have you had more conversations with him about the producers and about comedy in general?
No. I'm not going to talk to him about comedy.
You sound outraged by that question.
You know, it's like that old thing. If you have to explain comedy, you don't know it. you just don't. It's
So what do you talk about?
Well, I remember the one time when I saw him. I was doing a show on HBO called Luck that took place at a racetrack.
Yeah,
Mel loves the horses.
Okay.
He loved them. And he was with somebody who's a very good friend of mine, so I knew that Mel doesn't like to be bothered. And so I go up and I say, "Hey, Mel." And he goes, "Ah, Rich, hey, how are you?" And then he wanted nothing to do with me. So he was into the horses. He didn't want to talk to anybody. You know, what do we talk about? I don't know. You know, we talk about this, that, and the other thing. He did call me before I came to London, and he just went, "You're going to be great. You're great. You're great in this. You're a big bundle of talent. You're so loud." And I did for him the Hollywood Bowl, and he wrote about me, wrote a paragraph or two in his autobiography, which, boy, that thrilled me.
That's amazing.
I don't know. What do I talk to him about? I don't know.
Stuff.
He's a human being. I don't know. I don't know what I talk to him about.
I don't know what I would talk to him about.
You talk. He's a human being.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's an icon. But when you know what? If you talk to him about that or start hero worshiping, I'm not saying he doesn't have an ego. He knows he's the best. And I just say that. But he'd dismiss you if you started talking. Oh, Mel. Oh, he wouldn't want to worry. He wouldn't talk to you.
Yeah. No, I can see that. Absolutely. Yeah. First time around, you lost 30 pounds.
I did.
Have you lost any weight this time
around? Well, I have. Number one, I have. Number two, I go to the gym a lot.
Okay.
Because I do not want to go gentle into that good night, which is one of the reasons why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
I had yet to be seen. But this is not as physically taxing as far as jumping around, nor is the choreography as taxing. But there are two numbers where I'm huffing them, three. Where I'm huffing and puffing.
Yeah.
I'm huffing and puffing. Yeah. I mean, betrayal, certainly.
Yeah.
That certain one that I don't know how I do that. I still don't know how I do that. And then King of Broadway is a tough one. But they've let me, I take more breaths in that than I did on Broadway. The musical direction is a little different. I get to take pauses at certain places. I could tell you, there'll be gala opening nights again. Oh, no, that's the pattern. It's, I used to be the, I don't know what it is. I can't do it. I got to be on stage.
Which you do have to be in a few hours' time. What's your pre-show routine? What do you do?
All right, this is very interesting about London theater. London has a tradition of training and things like that. So you have to be at the theater an hour and a half before you have a warm-up, both a physical, you know, the dancers certainly, and the actors, to train their body. They physically do warm-ups, loosen up their body. Then they have vocal warm-ups.
Uh-huh.
They vocally warm up. Then you have a half hour to kill, and then it's half hour, because that's how long you have to get ready for the show. In New York, you come in half hour. So I'm there an hour and a half before. In New York, I don't have anything. I could be there at 10 minutes too and just go on stage. I'm not that good an actor where I got to get into character and everything like that. Here, I'm there an hour and a half before. So my goal is to keep my energy up for an hour and a half. That's my goal. So that when I walk on stage, and my adrenaline is still there.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you keep the energy up for an hour and a half beforehand?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. You just do.
It just happens.
Yeah, you keep it up.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tough to keep the energy up.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you go on stage. Going on stage is sort of like, every night you go there and in 2.5 hours, I'm living a man's life.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a man who is a disaster. All he needs, he wants a hit, he wants money. And then by the end of the play, he has it. It's a lot. You look at Death of a Salesman. You go to the theater. Willie Loman comes on stage. 2.5 hours later, he's going to kill himself.
Yeah.
It's pretty exhausting. That's a lifetime you're living through. And I'm not saying we're certainly it's not brain surgery, but a concentrated amount of time to live that man's life is a tiring thing to do. So you're sort of spent by the end. Truly, your brain, your body, of course, you're spent. Mm. Now, you don't carry it home with you, but you carry something that you've invested in. And it's like going to the gym. You go, I'll go to the gym. And then when you're finished, you feel different.
Yeah.
Because you've worked out.
Yeah.
At the theater, it's the same sort of feeling. You can't really describe it, but you're a little bit spent. You might feel better, you might feel worse, but you're different. You're physically different.
Mm. Well, I was exhausted watching you.
Yeah.
So
yeah, going enough already. Give me a break. Enough.
I have to ask, because we're a film podcast.
Go ahead.
I have to ask about Inside Out.
Go ahead.
Which is such a beloved film. And you as Bing Bong are very much a beloved character as well.
Yeah, I believe that. Yes.
Do kids recognize you for your voice? Because it's not, obviously you're using a different voice
kids
for Bing Bong.
But kids don't know. Adults know of a different voice.
Well, a slightly different voice. I wouldn't say that Bing Bong and you are exactly 100% the same.
I wish I were that talented. I can't change it. Maybe I'm in a higher register.
Yeah.
But it's what I sound like.
Okay.
Adults get it. I love it when kids who are the age of 8 to 14, 13, 14, when you say, I'm Bing Bong, their eyes brighten. It is the most lovely thing. Kids younger than 8, they don't recognize that somebody is a voice of a cartoon. Mm-hmm. But around the age of 8, they realize, that it's a cartoon, they're not real people, and this guy had to voice it. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
But even adults, when they find out Bing Bong, or they know that I'm Bing Bong, it's pretty special for them. I love it. As Frank Oz said to me, I'm the Jiminy Cricket, in this film, and I'm the Ed Wynn for this generation.
Yeah.
And it's true. And I have not, this is all Pete Docter's handiwork. He directed it, he wrote it, I voiced it, and I do a good job. But you ride the apron strings of much more brilliant people, and Pete Docter in this situation is the brilliant one. If you ever see the movie A Serious Man?
Yes.
Okay. The Coen brothers, I mean, I'm not saying I didn't do a good job, but hey, I'll ride those coach strings anytime. they're the geniuses.
That's one of the other films I wanted to talk to you about, because those guys...
They're the greatest.
That film's terrific.
It's a terrific, great movie. For those who have watched it, they respect it as much.
Yeah.
Do people know about it as much as some of their others? No, but that's their favorite movie, from what I hear.
People listening to this will know what
a Serious Man.
Yeah, they may even have double billed it with Inside Out. You never know.
You never know. Sure, one has great hope, and one is just let me kill myself.
It's a cosmic joke. Played on one man.
You're right.
Ultimately, yeah. I know from other interviews that you've done that you don't watch yourself?
I don't like to watch myself.
But have you watched Inside Out?
I don't like to hear myself.
Oh, so you haven't watched Inside Out then?
Yeah, I watched Inside Out. Okay. I have. First of all, I went to the premiere, so I'm there.
Okay, you watched that because Bing Bong's exit from that movie, shall we say, I think has traumatized an entire generation. So well done, Richard.
I am a Christ figure. Truly a Christ. I've died for her, not her sins, but I have died for her.
Yes.
I have given up my life for her.
Yeah.
It's the most beautiful thing in the world.
It's a beautiful.
I'm very proud. Very proud of it.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. Richard, I'm going to let you go because you do have to get to the Garrick.
I have to get to the theater.
You got to get to the Garrick.
I do.
It's been a pleasure. Richard Kind, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Richard Kind talking about The Producers. And if you want to see the show, which I can highly recommend, tickets are available at theproducersmusical.com. Richard will be playing Max Bialystok until around the beginning of May, and then Andy Nyman will return. Next up, You, Me, and Tuscany is a sun-kissed romantic comedy in which Halle Bailey flits from New York to Tuscany and falls in love with the lush landscapes, the gorgeous food, and the locals. Or in particular, one local, Michael, played by Reggie Sean Page. And when the two, that is Bailey and Page, popped into the pod booth recently, I went along and had a fun conversation with them about rom-coms, chemistry, Page's recent cameo turn on SNL UK, and more. Enjoy.
Halle Bailey, Reggie Sean Page, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How the devil are you both?
We're doing pretty good.
Great.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You jet lagged, you okay? Because I believe you were in the Napa Valley last week.
Yep.
Yeah, just a little bit.
A couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, jet lag wouldn't be too bad, I guess. Yeah. It would be bad.
We worked out that it's currently 3 a.m. on Halle's body clock, just so you know.
So I'm having a wild night out.
I like that. You haven't described it like that before. That's great. Wild night out on the Empire Podcast.
Absolutely. That's what all my interviews are, wild night outs. How do you counteract that body clock thing? Is it with the intake of wine from the Napa Valley?
It's coffee.
The worst thing is I don't like how in character Wild Night Out with my cup of tea is. We've summed me up very quickly.
So I believe I was talking to Kat and Will yesterday, also for the podcast, and they told me that the first time you guys met was at the Met Gala.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I'm guessing means one or maybe even both of you were dressed interestingly. Is that the case?
Yeah. Dressed extremely. I was wearing a cape, sir.
Hello,
it
sir.
It was a great cape. He was wearing a bright red cape. It was so cool. Like, he looked like a superhero. And I was wearing
about a
lot of sparkles. Yeah.
An entire suit made entirely out of sparkle in two different tones.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's not an ordinary Monday.
Yeah, but what it means is that we had this moment where I could catch Halle like a beacon across the room, just literally shining and glowing. And we knew that we were going to be in this film together at the time. So like,
okay,
you see this beacon. Because the other thing that no one tells you about the Met is that almost everyone goes alone. So you have a room full of the most glamorous people in the world at their most glamorous.
Yeah.
But also everyone's walking around going, friend. And so to see this kind of shining light of hope across the room going, hey, let's be friends, is not a bad way to meet your co-star, you know?
That's amazing. I see now why they've never invited me, because I'm very much, this is a jumper from Sainsbury's, and I don't think I could pull off a cape
or bring your sparkle,
glittering diamonds. How expensive was your outfit that night?
Oh, I don't know, honestly.
Were you worried in case there was like an Ocean's 8 style heist?
I did not think of that.
So all my diamonds have gone. Damn you, Sandra Bullock. Happens all the time.
That's such a good movie. I love that movie.
It's a great movie. So in terms of meeting at the Met, you know that you're going to be in this movie together.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're both dressed interestingly. That must be a huge icebreaker.
It was. And then to top it all off, Stevie Wonder came out. And was performing with
a
Usher.
A surprise collaboration set with Usher.
Yeah, it was incredible.
About as far away from us as you are now.
Mm-hmm. Shut the front door.
It was a lifetime moment. Yeah. It was incredible. And so to get to share that is the meet cute to end all meets. It really is.
Oh, yeah.
And then you were like, well, I guess we've got to go to Tuscany now after this. So,
you know, it's the a only hard way is life. Up. I'm not going to lie. We watched Stevie and Usher, and then we're like, shall we fly to Tuscany, yeah. hang out in some vineyards, drive through the rolling hills in film vintage convertibles, and maybe film a movie along yeah. the way?
It's occasionally film a movie along the way. Yet. Yeah. Oh my God, that is amazing. So tell me about the experience of making this movie. It must have been hell. You know, sun-kissed Tuscany, glamorous locations, wine on yeah. tap.
Yeah,
I feel so sorry for you guys.
It was absolutely incredible getting to film this movie. I mean, I feel like Italy is sort of becoming a second home for me because mm-hmm. I filmed a lot of Mermaid, half of Mermaid in Sardinia. Wow. And then I filmed this in Rome. We were there in Rome for like 5 to 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then we went to Tuscany for a few more weeks. And it's just so beautiful feeling like the community and the family energy that the people of Italy have and how everyone just wants to welcome you in and like take care of you like you're their own. Mm. And that was so special because you felt that and you can see it in the making of our movie. You know, you can see that. And we had a blast. It was just, yeah. it was a great time.
No, it was an incredible experience. And aside from just kind of what we got from it, the name of the movie is You, Me, and Tuscany. Tuscany yeah. is that third character. And we couldn't have faked that on Hollywood backlot. Like you could make it look like it. But our job, as much as we joke about we had a great time, which we did, was to sit in that culture. You can't separate food from land, from people in Italy. They're all one. You eat together. It's about how you eat.
Yeah.
What you're eating has a family story. Everyone's got their own olive grove. Everyone's growing their olives. They've got their own olive oil that you have to try. And you have to try the olive oil, not just because it's good, which it is,
yeah.
but because
yeah.
it's got generations of the family built in. Like, wow. Hallie learned how to make cacio e pepe from scratch. She can roll the pasta herself. And that has, like, different techniques in every region and has a family history built into it. And all of that, our job was to kind of sit in this paradise-like escape, but then just capture that, put it in the camera, put it in the cinema so that you can kind of come visit us. You get that escape when you buy the ticket, go into the dark room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And come into that real environment. You know what I mean?
My God. And did you have to immerse yourself a little bit more, Reggie? Because Michael has been yeah. there all his life.
So Michael grew up in Italy. Yeah. And that was important for me. I leaned in really hard for that because you don't often see characters that have multiple cultures embraced within them, that have grown up through multiple cultures. And I kind of wanted to make that feel real and lived in and natural. And so I spent a couple of months with an Italian tutor. I flew out early and kind of just hung out in Tuscany for a while, just to kind of let that sink in and seep in so that when he flips into Italian, when he has this kind of switch between his identity with his family, mm-hmm. his British identity, which was mm-hmm. a little bit easier for me to research, not really, that they both felt like they had a weight and a realness within him. And that gives us a nice, subtle complexity to play with when he meets the American. And you have the shared fish out of water experience, but yeah. also finding those connective commonalities, mm-hmm. which was another. I mean, like, the movie is this really fun romp of a rom-com and love and discover yourself. Yeah. But there's also all of this found family stuff.
Yeah.
We worked into the script that you're Hallie's from the South.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm talking about that food culture, like, that's what you grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, like, food and family, that's the South. And we worked that into the film. There's a line towards the end where it's like, here's my spin on this traditional Italian dish because yeah. this makes sense to me. This is familiar. And those familiarities, the things that unite us,
yeah,
that's what I love about rom-coms. Like, I'm actually pretty passionate about romance in that way because it is a vehicle for things you can't do in movies that are about punching each other harder than the other person. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you don't have romances in cinemas, you don't yeah. have movies where people talk through their problems and grow and become better at the end of it. And I think that's a pretty important thing in the ecosystem.
It very much is. It very much yeah. is. Hallie, do you feel the same way about rom-coms? Because they're an endangered species these days.
Yeah, I love a rom-com because of the escapism that you get from it. And also, like, how happy I feel and how I feel good after. I love watching something and feeling good after. And it's such a big impact. It has such a big impact on me, on a lot of people, because we can get away from our regular everyday lives and just sit somewhere and feel good, be taken on a journey and feel happy, you know, at the end of it. It's like, that's powerful. Even though it seems like, you know, something small, that's like, it's powerful.
There's something really interesting about how inevitable the end feels from the beginning. Yeah. So from the moment you two guys meet in this movie, you can sense that, you know, where it's gonna go, where it's gonna end up. And I was just wondering, as a pair, how did you navigate that journey? Because when Michael and Anna first meet, or Anna, because that pronunciation is a thing in the movie as well. When they first meet, obviously it's hate at first sight, but there's an underlying attraction there, and then you have to plot that across your various meetings. So how do you do that as a pair?
Yes. Wow. I feel like it was really easy, honestly, to build upon our chemistry because of the way their story has an arc.
Yeah.
So Anna, I love the fact that when she first meets Michael, she's like, not feeling him. She's mad at him. She's like, who is this? I love the fact that she doesn't like him at first because it makes it so much easier when you see them build and like, oh, that's actually cool about you. And it makes it feel real and something to build off of. So I love that arc and their relationship. And I'm also, I'm like a very fiery girl myself. So I feel like I would be like Anna if he took my sandwich too.
Hallie doesn't have a problem leading into the antagonistic aspects.
Oh yeah. So I feel like it was fun and easy to do, to play their story. Yeah.
We had a great kind of structure to that kind of enemies to lovers type trope, which was fun to play with. But also in terms of how the chemistry builds, like we've been talking about chemistry a lot. And for me, chemistry between actors is mostly about trust. Mm-hmm. It's about finding that space where Hallie is delightful, as you've no doubt picked up very, very quickly. I picked it up quickly. And it's about knowing that when you're making romance, every day is an emotional trust fall. And I knew very quickly that Hallie was going to catch me. And I think Hallie picked up pretty quickly that I'd catch her. Mm-hmm. And once you're there, you get to play. You can bring all the unexpected things out of each other. And the unexpected is chemistry. That's the chemical reaction where you don't know what's going to happen on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the scenes come to life. That first table read, Anna was there straight away.
Mm-hmm.
Like Hallie came to play. I came to play. We were both like, oh, this is cool. Like, I'm not talking to Hallie Bailey, who's just kind of reading some words on the page. Mm-hmm. I got to meet the woman who was kind of in my head when I was reading the script.
But excellent.
Real, unexpected version of her.
Yeah.
And that's what chemistry is in real life. It's meeting the full, real, unexpected version of someone else that opens up a whole new world for you.
Yeah, that's amazing. But obviously, movies are not shot chronologically. So what was the biggest whiplash for you emotionally in terms of portraying that relationship? Did you have a morning where you were slightly antagonistic, then an afternoon where you had to be more attracted to each other, or vice versa?
I think they did really good with not, well, I didn't have to do jumps in a day, at least. But I will say, our first scene that we did together, we were kind of hopping to the middle of the story in the film where Michael shows Anna
the kitchen,
the family restaurant.
Yeah.
And that was our first day of filming. So I had to I liked that scene was the first one that we filmed because Anna is in a new place and it's, you know, everything's new for her and everything was new for me. So I could play off of Hallie's experience too. But it was cool because Michael had to go in there and act like, oh yeah, this is my home ground. And that was our first day. We didn't really know anything.
Yeah. I think sometimes we had, there'd be contrast between, I think maybe we filmed pieces of the fight on the same day as like something very, very tender or intricate. And then you'd go to like the barrel race. And so that was a bit weird sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Just because also it gets sweaty as well. It was really hot.
Do the barrel race in the afternoon.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got to be a little careful with that one. Or going backwards and forwards in the sprinkler scenes.
Yeah.
Like soaked to not soaked is not an easy transition.
That was hard.
Emotionally it's hard. Or physically.
Yes. It's tough. You can't dry on command, right?
I had to learn. It's the old studio actor system. Dry, kid.
Yeah.
So, I've got to let you guys go, but when did that scene come in terms of the shooting schedule, the sprinkler scene in the vineyard?
We were in Tuscany. We were in Tuscany, so it was the end of filming.
First half of shooting was Rome, and then the second half, we had like 5-6 weeks in either location.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it was later on in the process. We were very comfortable by the sprinklers.
Yeah. Would you consider that an action scene?
Yeah, I would. Well,
there's a lot of running.
There was running involved. Yeah, definitely that was
slow motion involved. If you got to run in slow-mo, I'm saying that's an action scene.
The sprinklers weren't actually in the script. I just needed cooling down. And we're like, hey, get that.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
It was all improv.
It was all
I improv. Love that.
The
I
writer
love that.
Is out there. So the WGA is preparing their lawsuit now to come get me.
This is your rider that you actually have. People don't know this right now, but you can't see them on the cameras, but Reggae Sean has sprinklers with him right now.
We installed them pre-interview. In all situations, we need sprinklers at the ready. We're not turning up.
It's the best way. Most people have handheld fans to try and cool down, but not you. And I respect that.
I like that. You respect it. The makeup department does not.
Oh, no, it ruins all our equipment. Every single time. I should say that as well. It costs thousands of pounds worth of damage every single time.
Heath Ledger had the same writer. The Joker makeup was meant to be perfect. It was like pristine Jack Nicholson makeup.
Yeah.
Every single time. And then sprinklers.
Sprinklers. Every single time, which is why that movie cost so much.
That took a turn.
Yeah, absolutely. I do have to let you guys go. But very, very quickly, Reggae Sean, you were in SNL UK.
Yes.
Yeah.
The other night.
Just the other evening. That's I'm still so sleepy.
A surprise sprinkler-free cameo. But how was it?
I know. We're still talking to them about that. We're not pleased. We want the sprinklers.
The sprinklers were meant to go off the second I
They could even be funny. And yeah, that's the one place.
Oh my goodness.
Sorry, yes. Did SNL UK the other night. It was an absolute privilege. It was the first episode of them launching in the UK. So it was a joy to come in and be a part of that and contribute my little piece to kind of launching this incredible platform for British talent, British writers, British comic acting talent.
Yeah.
And getting to share the screen with Tina Fey, who is a lifelong hero of mine. So it big wins all around.
Absolutely. Hallie, can we expect to see you pop up on SNL UK?
Oh, I would love to.
Yeah.
Maybe one day.
Don't sound too loud. They're listening.
We're throwing it out there. Let's make it happen. We'll keep the sprinklers to one side, but we'll make it happen.
That'd be great.
All right. Well, on that note, Hallie, Reggae Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much
for
your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Reggae Sean Page and Hallie Bailey talking about You, Me and Tuscany, which is in cinemas across the country from this weekend. Finally this week, did you hear the one about the deadly podcast? No, not this one. The Emperor podcast doesn't kill you, although it has come close to bumping me off once or twice. No, instead I'm talking about Undertone, the directorial debut from Ian Tuwison, in which a podcaster played by Nina Keery bites off more than she can chew when she encounters spooky audio files that soon have a terrifying impact on her. We sent Mike Munster along to Zoomtown to have a chat with Tuwison and Keery, and that is what you're about to hear. Unembellished, you will be delighted to know, with any terrifying noises or backwards messages. Yajne.
I'm delighted to welcome to the Empire podcast Ian Tuwison and Nina Keery. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hello. Ian, Undertone is such an interesting idea. This is a movie that relies almost more on audio than it does visuals, actually. Tell me a little bit about the origin of this film. Where did the idea come from?
Started as a radio play. You're a radio host, aren't you?
I'm a horror podcaster, actually. Yeah, so there you go. Perfect.
Your setup looks so professional. But yeah, it was a radio play, like, you know, like Orson Welles, War of the Worlds. But then I added the elements of, you know, what Evie does in between recording, because my parents got sick, and then I got this idea of how, you know, a possession film about your dying parent would be really scary. So, you know, I experienced it. I knew it was going to be scary. So I revisited this radio play, and I started writing the scenes in between.
Nina, tell me, what did you make of the script when you first read it? What did you make of the character of Evie?
I felt very claustrophobic. I felt afraid. I was a little, honestly, I was kind of like, oh, I don't know. This is going to be like, it freaked me out. And then the next day I met Ian and Dan on a Zoom, and I was kind of like, okay, they're cool and normal. I feel safe around them. I can do this with them. But when I was just reading it myself, there is something scary about, first of all, because you never leave Evie and the space, the tension is just built in a really organic way in the script as well as the movie. And so I read it all through in like one go, no stopping, no like, oh, I'll get back to this later. It was just, it really freaked me out. And that's a good thing, but it also genuinely scared me. And then that made me a little bit like, okay, if there aren't the right conditions, I don't know if I can do this. And then when I met them, I'm like, okay, this is the right conditions. Like, these people, I trust them. And I see Ian's vision, and I like see his own personal vulnerability coming through. I feel safe to do this.
It must have been quite intense, Nina, as well. Like, because you are, like you say, it's basically you are on screen the whole time, right? I mean, you and it's essentially you by yourself for 90% of it as well. That must have been quite an intense experience.
It was, but it didn't feel like I was alone. We really had the experience worked because it was such a like easy group of people. Like, it felt so easy, you know. We just had because there was such a small amount of people in that space, there's like a streamlined effect where I'm like, I go upstairs and then I come back down, we do the scene, I go back upstairs, we do the scene. There's just, it's all there, you're in the same house, and there's something about like, it's almost like making something with your friends, in the sense that there's something just so familial. And because of that, when I think about us making it, I don't think like, oh, that was so intense and hard. Like, some of the scenes were really emotionally draining, but other than that, it was honestly pretty just like fun and light.
We went to the sauna like in my backyard after after shooting days.
Yeah, it was a makeshift sauna in basically like in like a tent or what is that like?
Well, It's a legit sauna.
A sauna. I love this. So this house where the film is set was actually your real house, Ian?
Yeah, it was
amazing. Oh my God. Okay. I love that. So you guys were all just hanging at Ian's house throughout this shoot?
Yeah, pretty much. That's why I was making them do the sauna, because
yeah,
they brought beer in and they were like, why don't you have it? It was winter time, so.
Oh, perfect.
It's lots of snow everywhere. It was really snowy February.
Oh, delightful. You must have all had wonderful skin by the end of this, Nina. You know, the snow, the cold snow and the sauna at night.
I only did the sauna at the end, but it was, the whole experience was, we were just like cozy at Ian's house making a movie. Like,
I love that. I love that. Ian, tell me a little bit about adapting this then from a radio play to a film. Like, what, and you know, I think particularly those scenes with the podcasting, what were the challenges in kind of, I suppose, making them visual, making them cinematic?
Yeah, it was hard at first thinking about it, because the portions where Nina's just listening, I had to make a list of things that could be happening, and eventually I came up with a bunch that made sense. Like, you know, did you get the idea that the stuff was happening or happened in the house that she was listening to?
Yeah, absolutely. But I suppose the fun of it, right, is that it's quite hard to tell what is coming from where, especially I watched it in a Dolby screening, so it really had that beautiful kind of surround sound, yeah, too, you know?
And while she's listening to these couple in the house, you know, sometimes I would just cut to the room that they'd be in, right? Like the kitchen or running down the stairs. Well, there's a bunch of other things too, like, you know, when she hears banging, I cut to different inserts to each bang. So it's like I stole that from The Changeling, that horror movie, 1980 with the wheelchair.
Yeah, I sensed a bit of The Changeling in there as well. The scene when he listens to the tape recorder in The Changeling, there's an element of that, isn't there? Yeah,
and then the push down the stairs.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that happens in The Changeling.
Nina, how did it work with those podcasting scenes when you are talking to somebody remotely or you're just listening to tapes? Like, were you listening? Did you have stuff that you could listen to and react to while you were filming it?
Yeah, so the Mike and Jessa tapes, I heard them for the first time when we were actually doing it. So
amazing.
That was really helpful. And the tapes are so good that even when I had heard them multiple times, they still freak me out when I hear them.
Yeah.
And then the conversations with Justin were actually like a live conversation, which I think was really helpful for me. And yeah, so those little tweaks, I think, made a big difference in just helping me have a genuine reaction and like feel as truthful as I could.
Ian, you make amazing use of kind of negative space as well, especially during those scenes. Like, I found myself constantly kind of looking in sort of doorways in the background and that kind of thing. Was that kind of an idea that you had in your head from the script stage, that was kind of how it was going to look?
Yeah, that was in my list of things that I was talking about. It's like, what can I do? Everything was planned out, every shot. So I had storyboarded the whole script before for shooting, and that made it easier for everybody. Every day, everyone knew exactly what I what I wanted.
Nina, she obviously, Evie is a character that is quite internal. You get the feeling that she's hiding a lot throughout this movie, right? And that we're maybe not seeing the full story of what's going on with her in this house. Like, did you kind of have an idea in your head of what Evie is really going through, what she's thinking, and did that kind of inform your performance throughout?
Yeah, I really, I think once I was sure about her way of moving in the world, like we all have our own ways of dealing with what's happening to us. And then I was like, oh, she's denying so much of what she's going through. And then that denial is causing her to spiral more and more. And then she has to deny more in order to compensate for that, which I think, look, I've done that many times in my life when I can't face something and then I have to deny it or compartmentalize it in order to get through what I'm getting through at that moment. Mm. And I think that was a really big key for me with her as a character. And then, I don't know, just having that grounding force of knowing her like point of view basically helped me just ground throughout the like shooting of the movie, because there's just moments when you're like, there's so much going on, it's like 11th hour, and then you're like, how do I ground myself right now, because I can't think about if this is scary or not or interesting or not, but I can think about like how to find this person where they're at right now, and that was helpful.
There's one look that you had in the reshoots that I loved. It was when Justin was telling you the stories about the psychologist study, and the girl that killed herself and she was pregnant, she drowned her baby in the sink, because you were kind of scared, but at the end your face just went blank. I don't know, do you remember?
It's that scene.
It's kind of like you gave up. It's like, yeah. Man, this is, it's almost like it broke you.
Because at a certain point, I think like that is just like sometimes you just can't handle things anymore.
That wasn't in the script, so I was really happy you did that.
Ian, how important, I mean, I imagine a lot of time went into the sound design in this movie, right, as well. And you know, you've got these, we've had screenings here in London where you get to watch them in Dolby and that kind of thing. How important has that been to you to kind of get the sound right in this movie, particularly for audiences as well, right?
Very important. It was in the script as well, the sound direction. I was specific to, you know, you hear the baby crying on your left, or you hear the bang above your head.
Mm.
But in surround sound, which is what we could afford, I can't pinpoint sounds that well. But I can give you general directions. But with Dolby Atmos, I put those sounds exactly where they were supposed to be.
How do you want people to watch it when they eventually watch it at home? Is this better to have like noise cancelling headphones on, do you think, for this movie?
More important than that, directional audio.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much every new headphone now that is capable of that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, are you a big podcast fan? Do you listen to a lot of these types of podcasts? Did you have to do that as kind of research for creating this fictional podcast in the movie?
I was a fan of, well, first started with Serial, and then and then some creepypasta people talking, you know, investigating these creepypastas. True crime podcasts.
Yeah.
Even scripted narrative podcasts I liked.
Nina, what about you? Are you a big podcast listener? Did you listen to a lot kind of before delving into this character?
I am a podcast listener. I didn't, I thought for a second, maybe I'll try and listen to some horror podcasts. And then I was like, I don't want to, that's not the vibe of Undertone podcasts. Like, so I didn't want to listen to that anymore. And I kind of just focused on like, story and character more than trying to recreate something. But in my own life, I listen to podcasts all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I had a podcast myself when I was at university. So
did you? What was your podcast?
Well, I was head of the news department, but then I also started my own podcast called Storytime, where I would bring in people in the like English department who were writers, and then I would find actors for them, and then we'd do like radio plays with the things they had written.
Amazing. I love that. Have you guys noticed as well, I mean, like, that with younger audiences for podcasts these days as well, more and more podcasts are becoming visual as well, which to me kind of defeats the point of podcasts. Like, what I love about it, as we see in Undertone, is it's such an like a kind of audio experience, really, more than anything else. But these days, more and more podcasts are becoming something where you just watch people sitting in a chair podcasting, right? Like, Ian, what are your thoughts on that, on the way that podcasts are kind of changing and growing?
Well, yeah, no, there's room for both. And every podcast is different. Sometimes you need that video element. If it's, you know, like with the Joe Rogan show. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like it's a talk show on TV. But I do prefer audio only, because sometimes I just want to close my eyes and,
yeah,
you know, lie down and listen, or
yeah, exactly. Go do some jobs around the house, do some chores while you're listening, you know. Sure. Like,
that's why I use podcasts. Sometimes I don't have motivation to do something, and then if I put on a podcast, I'm like, suddenly I've cleaned my house, I've done laundry. Like, it's just an easy way to motivate me.
Agreed.
Yeah, clean out the dead babies in the garbage.
Yeah,
the usual.
I did that just before we started.
Yeah. Ian, you mentioned The Changeling. Are there any other kind of horror movie favorites of yours that you kind of took inspiration from for this?
The Babadook.
Oh yeah,
the famous pushing in on the character and then stop pushing in when the character looks.
Mm-hmm.
2001 Space Odyssey, with when the noise cancels out.
Oh yeah,
on scenes that are scary. Hitchcock. There's the Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can kind of like, I can tell you exactly which film and which shot, but like, it'd be too long.
Yeah, fair enough. Nina, are you a horror fan? Do you kind of scare easily? What are your thoughts on horror?
I don't scare easily. I think as I get older, I see the deeper value of horror. I think when I was younger, some things would freak me out and most things didn't. And I was just like, no, I don't know. But when it comes to psychological thrillers, I'm a huge, huge fan of those. And I, those are the types of movies that I watch all the time. And I'm really happy that this is a movie about a woman unraveling, because women unraveling in thrillers is my favorite genre.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of those out there throughout cinema history, to be fair. Yeah.
Did Blockbuster have a... Oh, like a shelf?
No, I've created my own.
It should have, right? It should have. And horror seems to be, you know, people have talked a lot recently about horror having a moment. You know, we've just seen Sinners win multiple Oscars and Weapons and Frankenstein. How do you feel about that, Ian? Is this a good thing, or is horror becoming almost too mainstream?
Well, there's always room for, there's room for everything. But I don't watch those movies.
Oh, really?
I tried a couple, and then... I appreciate it for certain things, but I don't watch it to be scared. I'm not sure if many people do.
Mm-hmm.
There's different intentions for different movies, and as long as they nail their intention, then it's a good movie. But if I wanna feel scared, you know, I can't really watch a Frankenstein. It's more of a visual kind of, you know, experience, cinematic, Guillermo del Toro,
yeah,
type big thing, yeah,
visual feast for the eyes, absolutely, yeah. Obviously, Nina, this movie has been, you know, it's already been branded kind of the scariest movie you'll ever hear. It's been scaring audiences. Have you experienced it with an audience, Nina? Have you kind of like sat and watched it at any of these festival screenings or premieres?
Yes, I have, and there's a moment at the Sundance premiere, you know, at a pivotal moment in the movie when most people get really scared, and a woman went, oh. I will always remember that sound. It was like it was just pure dread, discomfort. And it was a very visceral sound. And I was so happy to hear it.
That's a good review for the film.
It's
yeah.
It's 5 stars and that's
it. The best kind of review you can get. Absolutely. Amazing. Ian and Nina, we're out of time, but thank you so much for your time. Lovely to meet you both.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, that was Nina Keery and Ian Tuison talking to Mike Monser about Undertone, which is in cinemas now. 4 stars, says Empire Magazine. And on that note, that is it for this episode of The Interviews. Thank you, as ever, for listening. The regular Empire podcast is out on Friday and features Team Empire talking about great movie quartets, reviewing Undertone, California Scheming, and more, and I talked to the great James McAvoy, who is now a director, in fact, of the aforementioned California Scheming. Right, that's enough for me. I'm off to keep my word to Richard Kind and watch Where's Papa. Hope it's a belter. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.